11. One day after work at the Pentagon in late 2017, Defense Secretary Mattis slipped quietly, unnoticed, into the cavernous National Cathedral in Washington. Mattis directed his security detail to allow him to enter alone so he could pray and reflect. He was growing increasingly alarmed about the possibility of a war that could kill millions. For the first year of the Trump presidency, Mattis had been living on permanent alert. North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un now had, for the first time, both nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, that could carry a nuclear warhead to the United States homeland. Kim had been shooting off missiles at an alarming rate. Mattis had monitored these in real time about half a dozen times through a top-secret national event conference, an emergency meeting of the military and national security team over secure voice communications. The conference put the senior leaders in direct communication, so they were poised to respond immediately. President Trump had delegated authority to Mattis to use a conventional interceptor missile to shoot down any North Korean missile that might be headed for the United States. If the word had come that it was inbound for Seattle, we were already launching interceptors, Mattis privately told others. If the North Koreans realized the United States had shot down their missile or had even tried to, they would likely prepare to fire more missiles. The potential we'd have to shoot to prevent a second launch was real, according to Mattis. That would require approval from President Trump, and the United States and North Korea might soon be in the nightmare of nuclear war. North Korea had several dozen nuclear weapons on mobile erector launchers, MELs, so they could be moved around and hidden. Mattis was surprised that the North had done such a remarkable job of hardening, dispersing, and concealing their nuclear weapons and missiles. President Trump's detachment compounded the problem for Mattis. "I never cared much what Trump said," Mattis said privately, because Trump's orders were so random, impulsive, and unthoughtful. "I ran the Department of Defense. I kept him informed in my private meetings. I wouldn't do it in public, because he would have to play a role then. But I didn't get any guidance from him generally, other than an occasional tweet." Only the president could authorize the use of nuclear weapons, but Mattis believed the decision would rest on his recommendation. "What do you do if you've got to do it?" Mattis asked himself. "You're going to incinerate a couple million people." "No person has the right to kill a million people as far as I'm concerned, yet that's what I have to confront." Trump's policy of maximum pressure on North Korea included not only draconian economic sanctions, but also an unprecedented personal rhetorical assault on Kim, threatening fire and fury and nuclear obliteration in scores of tweets and public remarks. The third element was military pressure. Here, Mattis was walking a narrow line. He had wide latitude to pressure Kim militarily, though the defense secretary understood that one person's perceived pressure could be somebody else's provocation. A longtime student of history, Mattis knew from memory one of President Abraham Lincoln's codes of war from the midst of the Civil War in 1863. "Men who take up arms against one another in public war do not cease on this account to be moral beings responsible to one another and to God." War could not be divorced from moral responsibility. Mattis often said he had seen too many boys die in his 40 years in the Marines. President Lincoln also had said, Mattis knew, "I have been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I had nowhere else to go." The majestic gray stone cathedral with its 300-foot tower is a spiritual home of the nation and slows time for anyone who enters. It seemed the right place for Mattis to go. He felt a solemn hush and walked the several hundred feet to the small war memorial chapel hidden from view at the rear of the cathedral. A few rows of chairs faced a modest altar and an oversized sculpture of the head of the crucified Jesus Christ, crowned by a halo of brass meant to suggest cannon shells. To Mattis, it looked like a bursting bomb. Inside the War Memorial Chapel stood a screen given by the 28th Marine Regiment on the 20th anniversary of Iwo Jima, the bloodiest and most vicious World War II battle, where the Corps had 26,000 casualties, including 6,800 dead. Mattis sat quietly in the candlelit War Memorial alcove. He had been in enough fights to know what one on the Korean Peninsula would entail. Chaos, blood, death, uncertainty, the drive to live on. Yet the question he needed to ask himself was how to carry out his assigned role, knowing his decisions might have epic consequences. If the country were in peril, he would have to stop an escalation by Kim. Nuclear weapons existed as a deterrent, not to be used. Use would be madness, he knew. But he really had to think the unthinkable to defend the United States. These awful thoughts had been in the back of his mind for months, and it was now time to bring them out front. He did not think that President Trump would launch a preemptive strike on North Korea, although plans for such a war were on the shelf. The Strategic Command in Omaha had carefully reviewed and studied O-Plan 5027 for regime change in North Korea, the U.S. response to an attack that could include the use of 80 nuclear weapons. A plan for a leadership strike, O-Plan 5015, had also been updated. Mattis stayed in the chapel for 10 minutes, unburdening himself as much as possible. He returned to the National Cathedral several more times that year around the close of business when few people were there. No one ever seemed to recognize him. Sometimes on these other visits, he walked across the nave through tall iron gates to the Holy Spirit Chapel, a small wood-paneled alcove with depictions of the Holy Spirit as a dove. A small sign said, "Quiet, please." He considered his reflections and prayer deeply personal. With each visit, he'd spend just enough time to feel a little stronger. There was never a point of complete comfort. "This weighed heavily on me every day. I had to consider every day this could happen. This was not a theoretical concern. Should there be a sudden military confrontation requiring a decision, he did not want, as he often said, to be Hamlet debating with himself, wringing his hands, indecisive and melancholic. He did not want to discover a hollow pit in his stomach saying, 'Oh my God, I'm not ready.' He had to find peace before the moment came. I was focused completely on how to prevent this or stop it as quickly as possible. Recognizing that the worst possible situation might dictate the use of nuclear weapons, with all that means in terms, not just that war, but the way it would change the shape of the world. That now nuclear weapons can be used again." He could not shake the moral or strategic implications. And there just comes a point where you have to settle that in your own mind with your own conscience. For months, Mattis had witnessed a maddening whirlwind of uncertainty, provocations, pressures, and the search for a diplomatic solution with North Korea, all the while carrying out the policy of maximum military pressure. After months of apprehension, on July 3, 2017, North Korea had launched its first ICBM capable of reaching the United States. On a trajectory to maximize distance, the Hwasong-14 could have traveled between 4,000 and 5,000 miles to Alaska, Hawaii, and perhaps even the West Coast. This was a genuine crisis. President Trump had publicly promised North Korea would not achieve this capability. With approval from Mattis, General Vincent Brooks, the commander of the U.S. and South Korean alliance, ordered a U.S. Army tactical missile fired as a demonstration and warning. The missile was launched from the beach along a path running parallel to the north-south border and traveled 186 miles into the East Sea. That was the exact distance between the launching point of the U.S. missile and the North Korean missile test site, as well as a tent where satellite photos showed Kim Jong-un was watching the missile launch. The meaning was meant to be clear. Kim Jong-un needed to worry about his personal safety. But no intelligence was picked up that indicated the North Koreans realized the U.S. missile could have easily been aimed north at the test site or at Kim. Western news coverage of the U.S. and South Korean demonstration was sparse. General Brooks said in a provocative public statement, "Self-restraint, which is a choice, is all that separates armistice and war." The South Korean military conducted its own live-fire exercise missile into the East Sea and said, "We may make resolute decisions any time." 3 weeks later, on July 28th, North Korea fired a more powerful ICBM. It could have traveled 6,200 miles and hit much of the continental United States. General Brooks ordered more demonstration missiles. In case anyone missed the message, he said in a statement that the Alliance Tactical Missile Test provides deep strike precision capability, enabling the Republic of Korea-United States Alliance to engage a full array of time-critical targets under all weather conditions. Again, there was no evidence in public or in the intelligence that North Korea understood. This demonstrated the limitations of trying to send messages with missile tests. At 5:57 a.m. on Tuesday, August 29th, sensitive intelligence showed North Korea was about to launch another missile. Mattis signed on to the top-secret national event conference. He could join in from the skiff in his residence on Potomac Hill, a government-owned compound near the State Department. The Pentagon had also created the capability for Mattis to sign on from anywhere in the world. When he was out of Washington in the United States or overseas, a communications team would be in an adjacent hotel or embassy room where they erected a secure skiff in a tent-like structure. He could vividly remember an aide desperately shaking him awake from restless sleep for a conference. Wherever he was, he regularly slept in his gym clothes so he could get to the national event conference as fast as possible. Even if he was being driven down a street, a second vehicle always accompanied his car. That was the communications team, not security. His communications equipment included a geospatial map with a small icon that would track the missile's anticipated flight path. From his location, Mattis could issue an order to shoot if the missile appeared to threaten South Korea, Japan, or the United States. Mattis had a light in his bathroom at his quarters in Washington that would flash if he was in the shower when the National Event Conference alert came. A bell would also ring in the bathroom, bedroom, and kitchen announcing that the conference was standing up because a North Korean missile had been launched or was ready on the launching pad. It was a non-stop crucible, personal and hellish. There were no holidays or weekends off, no dead time. On this Tuesday morning, U.S. military bases and ships with interceptor missiles had checked into the National Event Conference. Alaska was up and ready to shoot. Vandenberg Air Force Base in California was up. The Navy 7th Fleet. SBX, short for the Sea-Based X-Band, self-propelled mobile radar floats that formed part of the U.S. ballistic missile defense system, signed on. Mattis watched silently as information came in rapidly. Uncertainty and dread mounted. Was this it? NORTHCOM, the Defense Department regional command covering North America, quickly assessed that the missile was medium range and not a threat to the United States. But Mattis watched the icon for the North Korean missile arc up and out over the home islands, a World War II era term for the Japanese archipelago, and drop into the sea. If North Korea had a malfunction or a miscalculation, the missile could have dropped on the Japanese homeland, triggering a major international crisis. Flying directly over Japan was a clear escalation and changed the character of the threat. Secretary of State Tillerson was on the national event conference and declared, "North Korea is out of control." South Korea wanted to respond with at least a visible bombing training exercise within their borders. The next day, the South Koreans flew a unilateral F-15 bombing training mission, delivering munitions on a South Korea bombing range about 20 kilometers from the North Korean border. Mattis could see the maximum military pressure was not being felt or seen by the North. He began looking for more aggressive response options and wondered if they should take some actual bombing action in a North Korean port to send the message. One of Mattis's favorite books was historian Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August on the causes of World War I. Nations in Europe had all made elaborate plans for war, but none had actively sought war. In 1914, the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, Bosnia, set off the chain of events that triggered the war. By its end in 1918, more than 16 million soldiers and civilians had been killed. What chain of events with the North might trigger war? Mattis pondered. The intelligence gathering leading to the alerts was no less than spectacular, in a special category called exquisite collection. Mattis often knew within seconds of a launch. Computers would quickly determine where the missile would land. It took time to answer some of the key questions. Did the missile have a warhead? Was it a test? An attack? The national event conferences became smoother and more orderly. The training was paying off. No U.S. military radar failure, no failure of other equipment. "Ready to fire," Mattis heard each time. It was click, 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 click. Then they would all stand by and wait. Is this what the edge of Armageddon might be like? If there was a warning of a missile about to be fired, Mattis would often sign on to the National Event Conference early. Even if the trajectory indicated it was not coming toward the United States or was short range, he would stay on the network to listen anyway. It became his own drill, what he called anticipatory planning, for his role as sentinel, perhaps as decision maker to shoot down the missile. What would he say or order if? "Don't think that you can deal with this when the time comes," he told himself. "Sort it out now. Worst case scenario. And now it's time to go to church. Now, go back, dust off the war plans and study it. Are we missing something? Is there something else we can do?" On September 4th, North Korea conducted its sixth nuclear test. It was estimated to have 17 times the power of the Hiroshima bomb, and many scientists concluded it was a hydrogen bomb. 5 days later, September 9th, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Joseph Dunford summoned the senior military leaders to the tank, their conference room in the Pentagon. Dunford told General Brooks that they were looking for military options to ratchet up pressure and were worried that the United States was heading straight into war with North Korea. On September 22nd, Trump tweeted, "Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is obviously a madman who doesn't mind starving or killing his people, will be tested like never before." The following day, North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho called Trump "Mr. Evil President" in a speech at the United Nations General Assembly and said a strike on the U.S. mainland was inevitable. Trump responded later that day with another tweet. "Just heard Foreign Minister of North Korea speak at UN. If he echoes thoughts of Little Rocket Man, they won't be around much longer." The rhetorical overkill seemed mindless to Mattis. He believed that ridicule and taunting was unproductive, childish, and dangerous. "I got over enjoying public humiliation by second grade," Mattis once told the president. Trump did not respond, but continued the tweeting. On issue after issue, policy after policy, Mattis believed there were ways for a president to be tough and keep the peace. but not with the current occupant, because he doesn't understand. He has no mental framework or mode for these things. He hasn't read, you know, he told an associate. Reading, listening, debating, and having a process for weighing alternatives and determining policy were essential, Mattis believed. I was often trying to impose reason over impulse, and you see where I wasn't able to because the tweets would get out there. On September 25th, the U.S. command flew a simulated air attack, sending B-1 bombers and some 20 other planes, including cyber-capable aircraft, to cross the northern limit line that separated South and North Korea in the sea. The planes stopped short of entering into North Korean territorial airspace or over North Korea itself, but it was an extremely provocative action. The South Korean National Security Council met with President Moon Jae-in and sent word that the United States may have gone too far with North Korea. Details of these provocative actions were not explained publicly, and the American people had little idea that July through September of 2017 had been so dangerous. One day in his Pentagon office, Mattis addressed his senior staff sitting around the table head-on. It can seem like routine here, gentlemen. And if you're not concerned about war, well, war is very concerned about you. And if you're not attentive to this, no one is. Mattis believed there had been significant accomplishments at the Pentagon under Trump. Dramatic increases in military budgets, readiness, training, discipline, and new weapons. But he had a central running argument with Trump concerning allies. Mattis saw that the Europeans in NATO, the Middle East, South Korea, and Japan were essential. The relationships needed to be nurtured and protected. All the victories, he said, were becoming just submerged by this mercurial, capricious, tweeting form of decision-making. What, Mattis wondered, made Trump think anyone could make it alone in the world? What reading of history, what intellectual thought could give a person any confidence in that? A country always needed allies, he was sure. A person always needed allies. And this was the tragedy of Trump's leadership and the bottom line. It was inexplicable to think otherwise. It was indefensible. It was jingoism. It was a misguided form of nationalism. It was not patriotism. Trump's impact on the country would be lasting. This degradation of the American experiment is real. This is tangible. Truth is no longer governing the White House statements. Nobody believes. Even the people who believe in him somehow believe in him without believing what he says. When he walked out of his last visit to the cathedral, Mattis had cleared the decks. I'm ready to go to work. I'm not going to think any more about the human tragedy. If he were alive after such a war, he would sort it out in retirement at his boyhood home in Richland, Washington, on the banks of the Columbia River. President Trump said many times in public that he averted war with North Korea by meeting with Kim. He told me that Kim anticipated such a war with the United States. He was totally prepared, Trump told me on December 13, 2019. Did he tell you that? I asked. Ah, yes, he did, Trump said. He did. He was totally prepared to go, Trump replied, and he expected to go. But we met. In our December 30, 2019 interview, Trump again claimed credit. If I weren't president, we would have... Perhaps it would be over by now, and perhaps it wouldn't. We would have been in a major war, he said. But in February 2020, the thought apparently still gave him pause. It would have been a bad war, too, he told me. It would have been a rough war. DNI Dan Coats, who oversaw the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, said, "We all knew we were on the road to conflict." Kim told CIA Director Pompeo the same in their first meeting, that he was ready to go to war. We were very close, Kim told Pompeo. We never knew whether it was real, Pompeo later told an associate, or whether it was a bluff. Whatever the case, the U.S. had to be ready.